Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to PhillyFanatics.com's Philly Sports Talk. I am Eric Fisher. With me, Gordon Glantz. And Phillies, to update you quickly on the Phillies, who got one hit today by Jacob DeGrom in a Mets fans filled Citizens Bank Park, unfortunately. But we'll get to the Phillies later on in the program. Let's start with what I think was the big news of the week, and that is Dario Saric signs with the Sixers after 2 years playing for Turkey. Saric acquired in a draft night trade in 2014 by Sam Hinkie, and he's here. And Gordon, what does this mean? So you know, how big a deal is it that Dario Saric is going to play for the Sixers this year?
Well, it's a big deal for Dario Saric. He got out of Turkey just in time, considering what's going on there with a coup attempt and everything else. So I don't doubt that he was thinking of that. But in terms of, you know, they have the other prospect who plays there too, and you know, that could, I think he is Turkish, the other prospect, but that could affect when he comes over as well. But you know, aside from that, I'm glad they did it now. I mean, it was financial reasons, really. It was just going to be a business decision both ways that would have kept them over there. In terms of the team moving forward, taking a step in the right direction, and really, you know, we've been trying to say this for years, but hopefully we mean it this year, the core nucleus of what's going to be the team that's going to, you know, slowly progress forward into, you know, a playoff contender and then to a playoff team. And then maybe in, hopefully, you know, 4 or 5 years from now, a championship contender, you know, we want to see kind of the nucleus of what that team's going to look like, and the sooner the better. So completely from a strictly basketball sense, taking dollars and cents out of it, you know, and you know, the rookie wage scale and all those other things that I know have to be considered, strictly from an on-the-court basketball sense, the sooner you get him in here and see how he meshes with other people, which I know is an important thing that we're going to talk about, as the show progresses, I think the better. So there really is no negative to it. I was hopeful he would come over last year. I could see why it wasn't realistic last year. They really weren't expecting to contend. But really, you know, as each season progresses, I know he had one more year on his deal there, but I felt like there was really no reason, certainly from a Sixers perspective, to have separation from these guys on the rookie wage scale, for him not to be over there, so for him not to be here. So, you know, it's a positive any way you look at it, and I'm glad he's here, and I'm glad he's in the fold, and they can see where his game kind of fits and how he meshes with his teammates and where his game fits on the NBA level and kind of take it from there.
Yeah, we'll get – that'll be your next question, so I'm going to hang on to that one, how he fits in. Josh Landsberg is also with us. Josh, how important was it for the Sixers to get Dario Saric in here this year? Gordon just offered his opinion. Let's get yours.
I think it was very important. I think Gordon touched on a lot of the points. I think that they need to see how he meshes with the rest of the team. They have a logjam, with a lot of the big men. But I don't see – Saric is a guy that I don't see necessarily, you know, being in that role with Embiid and Okafor and Noel. I think he's more of a stretch player, not comparing him to a Hall of Famer. But if you're looking at a guy to compare him to, I look at him as like a Dirk Nowitzki type guy, a guy that can – that's not going to play down low, a guy that's going to step out and hit some threes. He shot over 40% from three overseas, and I think that he could be a guy that, you know, he's not going to play down low. He's not going to log jam the middle with Embiid and Noel and Okafor, as I mentioned, those three guys. I think that he's going to be a guy that can really shoot from the outside. And it's important especially this year with Ben Simmons being in his first year as a rookie. I think you might see Simmons play point guard a lot or point forward. And Simmons isn't a great shooter, obviously. He really needs to improve upon that. But the Sixers need to surround Simmons with shooters. And I think that Saric is that type of guy that can be a good outside shooter for this team and can mesh well with Simmons. And even if he comes off the bench or he starts, we'll see what happens. But I think that he can mesh well with this team. I think that he can be a good player and come in right away and contribute. And having the couple years overseas playing professional basketball, it's not, you know, quite the NBA, but there's a lot of great competition we see during the Olympics and during World Games, how teams overseas play really well and they compete with the U.S. teams. So I think that that's a valuable experience, and I think that it's important for him to get over this year and see what he can do.
Okay. Both of you hit on where I was going to go next, and that is, you know, how does he fit on this team? And, you know, he's not a, you know, we don't see him. I mean, we just read what we see, and you can see highlights. And, you know, he's not considered like a lights-out shooter. He's a decent shooter, supposedly. And, he scored, I think, 11 points a game. You know, but he's not a guy who's, you know, who's going to – I mean, you mentioned – I know you weren't comparing him to Nowitzki. You were just doing it style-wise. I mean, you know, he's not going to – he's not expected to score like that, anywhere close to that. You know, his best asset is passing and finding the open guy. He's a good rebounder. Gordon, doesn't that sound like Ben Simmons? And so my question is, if Simmons is playing and you have at least one big guy on the court, if not two, because if they have three of them, they can't – you know, if they don't trade any of them, you know, I can't see them keeping, like, you know, Okafor on the court while Noel and Embiid sit on the bench together, and then, you know, one guy subs in. That doesn't seem right. And how do these guys fit together on the court? Now, let's go with Simmons and Saric specifically. How are they going to fit?
On the court, you know, I think it's one of those things that they're going to have to figure out as they go along. You know, I think right now it's there's two ways to look at it, a good problem or a bad problem. And I think it's a good problem that you have two really young, talented guys beginning their NBA journey at the same time. And, you know, you don't know quite once they get on the NBA stage what part of their game is going to work and what part of the game isn't going to work. You know, I again, like you said, we just read more about Saric than we actually see. You know, I have watched YouTube, but that can only take you so much. They can make a lot of stiffs look pretty good on it if you watch a YouTube highlight reel. So, you know, but from what I understand, you know, he can kind of be that point forward, but the feeling was that maybe kind of like what Josh touched on in the NBA, does he quite have that kind of skill to really handle the ball as much, especially in open court, if he got onto the NBA, you know, onto an NBA floor in a lot of situations the way Simmons could, which would make him more of a versatile forward that could be, you know, he could play the three a little bit, and maybe he could be too strong physically for a smaller three. And maybe he could be, if he played the four, he could be a little too quick for, you know, some guys who are maybe, you know, 6'11", you know, 7 foot, who are, you know, don't move as well as he moves. So that may be the kind of role he falls into. If he gives you more in terms of handling the ball and passing, I think he may pass within their half court offense, maybe a little bit better than Simmons will right now. I see Simmons more as a guy who can maybe grab a rebound and get out on the break and lead the break himself and find the open guy. You know, that I think maybe when you get more in a half court, you know, you see Saric, you know, his game may be more developed. And you know what, right now, I really, you know, I may be going on a limb here. I think he may be the best thing that could happen for Ben Simmons right now, because it may take a little bit of pressure off him as a guy who only played 1 year college ball on a team that was very average. You know, you have a guy who played overseas for a couple of years. It's not the highest level, but it's you're playing against grown men. It's very physical. They bang around a lot, and I think you're going to see a guy who's a little bit more mature physically. Obviously, he may struggle with the language and the culture and some of those other things, but you know, he may be the best thing that happens for Simmons just in terms of pressure, especially early in the season. And, you know, and it's another piece for Brett Brown to work. We're going to find out what kind of coach Brown is now. You know, there's no more excuses. And we're going to find out now how he fit the pieces together. But I don't think it's a bad thing to have two high-level talented guys who have some skills that overlap.
Well, Gordon, you led me right into my next question. I was going to ask Josh. And, Josh, you know, if this doesn't work out, they're not going to get rid of Darius Saric, and they're not getting rid of Ben Simmons. The guy who this is going to fall on is Brett Brown. So I guess my question is, how much pressure is he going to have now to make this work, and how is he going to do it?
I think he's still going to have another year, because there's a lot of new players, you know, a couple new players coming in, and Joel Embiid and Darius Saric, and it's going to be hard to kind of work all these guys in and see what he can do. But Gordon mentioned there's no more excuses, but I still think he gets at least one more year this year. He is under contract, and I think that, you know, they're probably not going to be, or not probably, they're most likely not going to be a playoff team this year. But you want to see some improvement. You want to see them get into that 20-win range. To get up to 30 wins would be a 20-game improvement. That would really be impressive if Brett Brown can do that. But I think there is some pressure on him. But I think at the same time, he does have kind of a year to see what all these guys can do, whether there's a trade at the trade deadline. It's really interesting with a lot of things going on. I think teams out there think the Sixers are desperate to make a move, so they're not going to give up quite as many players or quite the players the Sixers want, so that's why the Sixers haven't made a move. And you could see the Sixers, I mean, it's really interesting. I know it's not the question you asked, but I just wanted to touch on it. I think that you could see, you know, speaking of Brett Brown, how he's going to work this, could there be a lineup of 6'10 or taller guys? Could it be Ben Simmons at the point, Darius Saric at the two, Noel at the three, Okafor at the four, and Embiid at the five? I don't know if that's going to happen or not, but that would be a pretty crazy scenario, and no team in the NBA would be able to boast that type of lineup. And I know it's a small ball league, and you have teams like the Golden State Warriors, but we saw the Cavaliers go big in the finals, and that helped them win the championship. And, you know, you did have the Spurs back in the day with Tim Duncan and David Robinson, 2 7-foot guys in there. So there is the precedent for this where you have a big team, but not quite that. I think it's more likely a guy like Jared Bayless will start at the point maybe, and Nick Stauskas. He's still young. He's only going to be in his third year. He could be the shooting guard, so or he could come off the bench. So a lot of potential lineup mixes in there, but I think, you know, if I put my money on it, I would say there's going to be a trade at the trade deadline. A couple trades that were out there, the Boston trade didn't go through, which might have been a good thing because I would have rather seen them trade Okafor than Noel. And I think Boston would have fleeced them in that deal, getting the 23rd and the 26th pick and Noel and Robert Covington, just a great move for the Celtics, but they didn't do it. They didn't pull a trigger. And then there was a rumor that Okafor would go to the Lakers for Russell so the Sixers could get their point guard, but that didn't happen. So as of right now, they have five guys that are 6'10 or taller on this team, and they have play different styles. You know, Simmons and Saric are guys that can handle the ball more and pass the ball and play on the perimeter. And then you have, Okafor and Embiid that play kind of down low more. And actually Embiid has a pretty good outside shot, you know, mid-range game. And we'll see if he can stay healthy or get healthy in the first place. And then you have Noel, who's a rim protector and doesn't have much offensive game. So yeah, it's a big if with Embiid, but if he does get healthy, he could be, you know, one of the premier centers in the league. So we'll see what happens. But, you know, I'm just curious what your guys' thoughts are on if that lineup actually happens at some point in the season, whether at the beginning of the season or later on in the season. How crazy would that be to have five guys, 6'10 or bigger, on the court at the same time?
That is crazy, Josh. I remember at your alma mater and mine when we put up five guys who were 6 feet or taller in the high school lineup, and that was a big deal when that finally happened. I was not one of them, but we did have five guys 6 feet at one point. But, yeah, 6'10", that would be really interesting. And, again, it would be a question of how do the pieces fit. You know, how do those pieces fit? So we'll see. We do have that's going to be Brett Brown's going to have his work cut out for him. We do have a caller on the line. Caller, I want to give you an opportunity to ask a question or make a comment if you'd like now.
Yes, I like Josh's idea for the big man lineup. I thought that some way to think about this is the small ball, it's so in fashion now, only works if you're the only one doing it. And when you're big, if you're the only one doing it, you may have a chance of success that they're not thinking about. And I think it's going to be up to Brett Brown to figure out how to make it work. But I like the idea of height. You can't coach height, as Jimmy Lonnie used to say. And if you can do that, no one's going to be able to drive to the basket. And you got to just be quick enough on the exterior, which looks like Ben Simmons is. So I'm really intrigued with Josh's idea of playing big instead of small ball, because now everyone's going small ball. If you're different, you have a better chance of success. What do you think?
Yeah, I was going to ask you, I'm glad you brought this up, because whether it was the lineup or not, I mean, one question, the biggest question on Saric right now, just again, judging from scouts' comments and from people who watch, you know, his full games, is really at the defensive end and whether he's going to be able to keep up if he has to play, you know, if he has to play three, for example. You know, does he have the speed to do that? There's some questions about Simmons at the defensive end. Okafor, we know there's lots of questions based on his first year. You know, so the offensive end is intriguing. So I'll ask you the question back. You know, do you think it's going to work at the defensive end, or how can it work? You know, if they have they're covering fast guys on the other team, but whether it's small ball or whether it's, you know, it's just a forward with good mobility, you know, are the Sixers equipped to do that?
Well, I think that, as I said before, defense is really one of if you want to do it. And offense is a skill set that I think they have. Do they have enough offense? And with Okafor and Embiid, if he's playing, is enough offense. I think Saric comes off the bench. I think they need another guard, true guard, and they can pick one up. They'll have to make some kind of trade somehow, but that's what you got Colangelo there for. They'll figure that out. And if it's not this year, it's next year. I think the biggest improvement is 30 games that a team ever did, and that was with Duncan. I think Larry Bird had 28 or 29. So the Sixers get to 30 wins this year. That's going to be a tremendous improvement. They'll have another lottery pick, and they'll have other Lakers and other picks all over the place that the plan's coming together. By 2018, 19, they're competing for the Eastern Division.
You think they'll be competing? Not this year, but the following year after they have the 2016 picks? 17 picks, I'm sorry.
Yeah. When they get one more draft and trades in between. This year they go from a slot from the worst team in the league to missing the playoffs, getting a top draft pick, getting lucky in the draft, and coming back the following year with a 3-4-5 seed.
Gordon and Josh, you have a reaction to Bill's comments there about the Sixers and their, I guess, projection on where they could be in a year and a half, 2 years?
Yeah, I mean, I like that timetable. I mean, like the caller said, I mean, they really could end up with, you know, if they get that Lakers pick, and assuming the Sixers improve but don't drastically improve, you're still talking about picking in the lottery. You could be talking about picking maybe 5th and 10th, 6th and 12th, something like that. You know, you're talking about adding two more lottery picks to the fold. I mean, this year adding not only Ben Simmons, but Saric and Embiid, who are lottery picks from previous years. So that's three lottery talents coming in. So it's potentially very exciting, but, you know, it's again about pieces and making them fit. And that's, again, really where it falls on the coach. So much of that is important. You know, if you remember the Sixers team from the 70s, they actually didn't really get better until they moved McGinnis and Free, and they actually kind of tailored a team. They brought in Moses to get them over the top, but they sort of brought in other pieces. And then, you know, you look at the Allen Iverson team that made the finals. Same thing. They had a lot of talented guys like Stackhouse and Derek Coleman and several other guys like that. But they really kind of built a team around Iverson and let him be the main offensive threat, and some other guys like McKee and some other guys who could fill in. So it's really, they could even kind of scale it back and add some more defensive-minded guys. You know, it's going to be interesting to see how it evolves, but I certainly see, like, a two-year timetable until they're really in the mix, you know. And, you know, it's exciting. It's going to cost a lot of money to keep all these guys here. But, yeah, that's kind of phase two. We got to get through phase one right now.
Thanks.
Josh, reaction?
Yeah, my reaction is I think that, you know, next year's draft is actually a really deep draft as well. It's got a lot of good players potentially coming out. And Gordon mentioned, you know, the Sixers could, you know, get that Lakers pick. It's top three protected, but you hope the Lakers improve to at least, you know, the fourth or fifth worst team in the league. You know, I know Lakers fans would hope that they improve. So the Sixers would get that pick. They could get like 5-10 or 5-8, something like that. And you look at the Golden State Warriors, who won the championship 2 years ago, and this past year were one game away from winning back-to-back, and they go 10 deep. So I look at a team like the Golden State Warriors, who has a lot of players. You don't just need a starting lineup that's got a lot of flash and panache. You need bench players that can really help you out. So those two lottery picks next year for the Sixers could be bench players. They could be starters. Who knows? But, you know, you're building a nucleus now of a great starting five and backup players. And a couple guys I'll throw out there, great snipers and sharpshooters, J.J. Redick and former Sixer Kyle Korver, become free agents after this year. So the Sixers could get one of them for next year to be their shooting guard. So there's a lot of potential for this team, not both in the draft and free agency. And I see this team competing, you know, probably for the playoffs, not this year, probably 2018, maybe 2017, or probably 2018, and really competing for an NBA championship potentially by 2000. You know, Gordon mentioned 4 or 5 years. I agree with him. I see that range. You know, LeBron will be a little bit older toward the end of his career. So you hope that, you know, he's not such a powerhouse anymore in the East, and the Sixers can move in there and be that powerhouse team that competes for an NBA championship in 3 to 5 years, I would say.
All right. So a lot of optimism about the Sixers, and we'll see how that plays out. Obviously, this year we'll see if they're able to trade one of the big men and what that means. Bill, thank you very much for the call and a good question. Touched off some nice conversation. There's an other NBA issue I want to get to, which is Tim Duncan's retirement, but I might save that for archive, and we'll get to the Phillies. The trade deadline's August 1st, and I'm going to throw some names out here. I think there's some obvious names, and maybe not some guys that aren't as obvious. For example, the starting pitching, you know, they're not going to trade Zach Eflin, Jared Eichhoff. Velasquez isn't going anywhere. The guy that's obviously is on the market is Jeremy Hellickson, who's a free agent after this year. But let me throw out this. If somebody made you an offer for Aaron Nola, and obviously it depends on what it is, but would you even listen to an offer for Aaron Nola? Gordon, why don't you start there?
I would, you know, overall, the Phillies have a lot of leverage this year that they didn't have in previous years. And they have a lot of leverage because of trades they made last year at the deadline, you know, and at the waiver deadline as well. So I certainly listen to anything that's offered, but I'd be real reluctant to move Nola unless somebody really, really gives you back a pitching prospect. Maybe it's a pitching prospect who's a year or two away, but a really blue-chip pitching prospect along with a blue-chip fielding, you know, position player prospect. Then I guess my ears would have to perk up a little bit. But otherwise, you know, while I wouldn't say if somebody brings up the name Nola, I wouldn't hang up the phone on them. I would hear them out, but I would be very reluctant to do it.
Josh, guys really held this back end of this bullpen together. Two guys, one up and down a little bit, Hector Neris, but a bad stretch. It's been pretty solid in the eighth inning except for, I guess, last month. And Jeremy Gomez, who, you know, emerged as the closer, has 25 saves. Obviously it would hurt the Phillies this year, you know, to lose either one of these guys, especially Gomez. But if a team called asking for Gomez, would you be willing to move him?
Well, you know, I think that's, you know, I was reading up, you know, I saw your email, obviously, with the topics of the week. You send out every week, and reading up on some of the players, an article that Todd Zielecki wrote about some of the guys. I was a little surprised to see Jenmar Gomez's name up there, but you got to go back to what happened with 100 Miles Giles, and that was a phenomenal deal. They got back a lot of guys. He hasn't pitched well, or at least in the beginning of the season, he didn't pitch well, and he wasn't, he got demoted to the eighth inning, wasn't even a closer, so I think for a team that's not a playoff team, a closer is kind of expendable, and Gomez has had a great year for them, and relievers are kind of finicky. You never know. They're a little helter-skelter. He could have a bad year next year. You never know. So I would certainly be willing to listen to some offers for him. I think they could get a lot of for a team that really needs a closer bad that's in the hunt, in the playoff mix, they would certainly look at a guy like Jenmar Gomez, and I think the Phillies should consider moving him because they could get a lot of good prospects back. And they're still building for the future. They're you know, they're a few years away from contending. They're not going to contend next year, most likely. So I think that a closer is a position that you can kind of always find, whereas starting pitching and you know, position player help is not always – you don't always have enough of that. So I think that I would be willing to listen to offers for Gomez for sure.
Okay. Like you said, you don't need a closer. You know, you always don't want to get rid of a guy who's going to be your closer in the future, and they're not going to get what they got back for Ken Giles. But they could. You're right. They could get some things that could help them down the road, and then they just have to find another closer. Gordon, I'm going to ask you about a guy because you brought him up last week when we were doing our Phillies grades. You know, catcher is a position the Phillies have a lot of depth at, and Carlos Ruiz is in his last year of his contract. Obviously, if you get something for him, not that you want to get rid of him, but you know, if you got something valuable for him, you have to trade him. But what about Cameron Rupp? I mean, they do have some catchers coming up in the system. If Cameron Rupp's had a really good year this year, I forget if you gave him a B-plus or an A-minus last week, if somebody called and was looking for a catcher, would you listen to offers for Cameron Rupp?
I guess similar conversation to Nola. It wouldn't be, again, different than Nola because in Nola's case you have other guys. In Rupp's case, yes, they do have some catchers. I mean, they acquired a catcher from Texas in the Hamels trade, and they have a couple other catchers in the system. But, you know, I think it'll be almost be maybe a year premature. Let's see how these catchers continue to progress, and then maybe a year from now we could talk about Cameron Rupp. I would be very hesitant to do it right now. Ruiz, as you mentioned, I would you know, it actually would help two ways. It would, you would get something back for him. It wouldn't be a lot, but it would maybe give him a chance maybe to play for a contender again at the end of his career. And you could call up one of those catchers and start to give them a taste now, and you can start to get a sense of this, if that guy is big league ready at the time. Is he shovel ready? So, it could help you in two fronts there. It could help you, you know, get some prospects for Ruiz, helps Ruiz out, and you may bring up a catcher, get him some major league experience at the same time. So, in terms of trading Ruff, I think I'd be a little hesitant just because I don't think they're quite ready organizationally to do that.
Okay. Josh, we're going to go another position here. And again, some of this is all predicated on who they have coming up through the system. And obviously, J.P. Crawford is the shortstop of the future. Would you listen to trades for Freddie Galvis, who terrific fielder, you know, he's only hitting .229 this year, Freddie Galvis, or, I'm calling back to last week, this is a guy you brought up, so just I asked Gordon about Cameron Rupp, who he brought up with grace, Cesar Hernandez. Let's say there was an offer for him, in which case you'd say, well, you know, we could move Galvis to second base next year and bring Crawford and shortstop. Would you listen to trades for either Hernandez or Galvis?
Yeah, I think I would listen to trades for both those. The problem with going back to what Gordon said about Cameron Rupp, it may be 1 year premature. You don't necessarily want to throw in J.P. Crawford as your everyday shortstop this year. That might be a year premature. Maybe bring him in as a backup. Call him up as a backup and have him as your everyday shortstop next year, and trade Galvis, before next year at the trade deadline next year. So I think I would listen to offers, but at the same time, I think that Galvis and Hernandez are good fielders. And Hernandez, you mentioned, we talked about him. I gave him a higher grade than you, but he really came on strong toward the end of the second half of the first half of the year. And, I don't know who they would have play second base. You mentioned they could play Crawford at short and move Galvis over to second. But Galvis is a good fielder, but obviously he's not a good hitter, and he's not a major league hitter. He's more of he's playing as a starter for the Phillies, but he's probably better suited as a utility player or a backup player. So I would listen to offers, but I think I would stand pat and keep Hernandez and Galvis and bring up Crawford as a backup player.
And the other guys all seem kind of obvious. The other guy gets mentioned, Peter Borges, who, you know, is a free agent after this year. He's been a pretty good player for the Phillies this year. But you got Aaron Altair, who might be back up this year for that matter, with his injury, if he gets his rehab. You have Nick Williams down there getting ready. Some point somewhere in the next year or two, the Phillies have to be hoping he's up here. So, yeah, Hellickson and Borges seem the most likely guys to go, but I think there's some other interesting names out there. Like, you know, Gomez, I think, is a real possibility. Anybody think Ryan Howard could go?
I think there's a slim chance that Howard could go at the August 31st trade deadline to a team that's, you know, maybe just wants a left-handed bat to rent for a month. But if the Phillies are picking up the paycheck on it anyway, but you know, maybe you'll get a low-level prospect then. But now I doubt it. Seriously doubt it.
Yeah, I'm sure they, you know, and at this point, the only thing I think that's helpful there is, you know, at that point, it's not that much to unload his contract. So it won't cost the team that much, although, you know, other than home runs, you know, I don't know what he really adds at this point. But we're gonna save the Tim Duncan discussion for archive. I just want to say, check out PhillyFanatics.com. We do have I'll have a Phillies notebook up soon talking about the trade deadlines. I do have a column up on Tim Duncan, Gordon's 53-man roster, if you haven't checked that out, for the Eagles' projected 53-man roster is up there. I'm going to have a Fish and Chips column up by tomorrow, maybe tonight, but certainly by tomorrow, that will deal with a lot of the Sixers issues, with the Darius Saric issue and how he fits into the team and, you know, about trading the big men and all that stuff. So please check that out, and thank you for listening, those of you that are listening live. Couple dates. Eagles training camp starts, so they start reporting a week from tomorrow. And, of course, the trade deadline, August 1st. So thank you for listening live. And if you're not listening live, just hang in there because we're moving into our archive segment. And we're going to start that archive segment with Tim Duncan, who retired this past Monday. Gentlemen, Tim Duncan retired this past Monday. In typical Tim Duncan form, they issued a not too long press release, about 8 paragraphs, most of it was statistics, no quotes. They had no news conference for Tim Duncan. But my question for you is, and Josh, we'll start with you, where does Tim Duncan rank? I don't have to give me a specific number, but because I saw this debated a little bit on Facebook. Actually, Gordon, a friend of ours, wrote a column that he posted on his own site. Where's Tim Duncan rank in terms of his standing in NBA history? So, Josh, you go first, and we'll go to Gordon.
Well, I think it's simple. I think he's the greatest power forward to ever play the game. You know, it could be argued maybe Karl Malone, but Karl Malone doesn't have the championships. Karl Malone is second overall in scoring, only behind Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and Tim Duncan is 14th. So there's that disparity between the two of them. But I think Tim Duncan is the greatest power forward of all time. If I was doing an NBA first team and an NBA second team, I would have Tim Duncan as my first power forward and Karl Malone as my second power forward. So I think that that's clear right there. And I think that he's either the greatest or the second greatest player of his generation. You look at his numbers, it's either him or Kobe Bryant. Both of them have 5 championships. Kobe Bryant is way ahead of him in scoring. Kobe Bryant's 3rd overall in scoring. Tim Duncan, once again, 14th. Both of them had great coaches. Tim Duncan with Greg Popovich and Kobe Bryant, of course, with Phil Jackson most of his career. So you look at that, there's a lot of comparison there. Tim Duncan, both of them had great players surrounding him. Tim Duncan early on in his career had David Robinson to win that first championship, and then most likely Hall of Famers in Tony Parker. Manu Ginobili is kind of a borderline Hall of Famer maybe, and just great supporting cast around Tim Duncan during his championship. So, and Kobe, you could argue, didn't have quite a great supporting cast. Not the first 3, obviously, with Shaquille O'Neal, but his next 2 he won. He had Pau Gasol, who was a pretty good player, obviously, but probably not a Hall of Famer. And then he had Andrew Bynum, who had a couple good years there, but I think it was more Kobe kind of running the show those last 2 championships. So, but overall, I think Tim Duncan is the greatest power forward of all time, and the first or could be argued either the first or second best player of his generation.
Thank you, Josh. I wish you could have done that without mentioning Andrew Bynum, whose name we try not to mention on this show.
Sorry about that. He was good with the Lakers, didn't work out with the Sixers.
That's right. Gordon, how about you, Tim Duncan?
You know, when Josh first made that statement about the best power forward in the history of the NBA, I kind of got a little lightheaded. I'm like, wow, that's quite a statement. But then after hearing him talk, he convinced me. and that's why when he retired, it wasn't a big shebang. I mean, they put out the press release, they put out the stats, they put out, you know, what he accomplished, because it speaks for itself. The ring is the thing, no matter what the sport is. If you win a championship, you know, it matters more than if you average 19 points a game and won a championship, as opposed to averaging 22 points a game and being on a team that only got to the first round of the playoffs. So, you know, championships are important. He was a vital part of that. I mean, David Robinson was kind of, you know, not quite the same David Robinson during some of those championships. He wasn't the same David Robinson he was in his prime, and Duncan was really the main guy inside. You know, I guess the only thing it would be a quibble is or is not Larry Bird considered a power forward? Or, you know, I guess if you look at that team, McHale was the power forward, so that would actually be an argument for another day. But yeah, I mean, Josh, he kind of you know, set me back a bit with his statement, but he kind of convinced me with his explanation. So I'll go along with it.
Good. Well, I'm going to make it unanimous, because I pointed that out in my column. And Josh, you and I are right on the same page in terms of Duncan and then Karl Malone. And I made LeBron a 3 if I had to put that team together. I had a Bird, by the way. But yeah, I think, look at Duncan. You know, not only did he score, which he did, but he had he was on the All Defensive Team 15 times. No one else in history has been on the All-NBA defensive team 15 times. And I would, you know, also argue that in terms of supporting cast, I mean, without Duncan, Manu Ginobili is nowhere near a Hall of Fame player. And I would argue that I'm not sure – I don't think he is now. And I'm not sure Tony Parker's a Hall of Famer. And without Duncan, he's not. Greg Popovich, and I did mention this in my column, people always ask Greg Popovich about, you know, what makes him such a great coach. He's being overly modest, but he always says Tim Duncan. And sometimes that's all he says. You know, he says Tim Duncan. That's why. And I think it's really, and I put this in my column just to add to, I'm not going to add to all the stats Josh said by quoting more stats, but I think the other thing with Duncan is just his, he's so coachable and he's so modest and he doesn't have that same ego. I mean, everybody has an ego and they want to be a great player, but, you know, they fit the pieces around him and there was never a problem. You know, you rebound a little more, okay. We need you to score a little more, okay. You know, we're gonna run the offense through this guy a little more. As Kawhi Leonard became a better player, Tim Duncan was okay. You know, he never let ego get in the way of his team's accomplishments, and that's what he was all about, was his team's accomplishments. Sometimes I think we overrate championships. You know, this guy never won one, this guy did win one. When you win five, and you're a key player on all five of those teams, I think it matters. So I'm going to add Tim Duncan's style, which made him a better player and which made his teammates better, to his Hall of Fame credentials. So we're all in agreement on that one. All right, let's go to final thoughts. Gordon, why don't you start us off on final thoughts?
Yeah, and one last final thought on Tim Duncan, because you talk about the ego, and he wasn't that type of me guy. But can you imagine if he was, and if he also played in a place like New York or Los Angeles? It just, you know, I think the fact that he was in San Antonio and he wasn't a guy who caught a lot of attention to himself, I think that's why, you know, that's part of why we have to kind of debate this a little more than we do. In terms of final thoughts, we didn't talk much about the Eagles. I know you're going to talk more about the Eagles next week, and unless I have a lot of delayed flights, in which case I'll be miserable, I will be unable to join you. But one thing I'm looking forward to a lot of things with new coach to see how the culture changes. Because it's going to be a completely different team. I think the offense is going to be very methodical, you know, as in terms of hectic as it was with Chip Kelly. Sometimes it worked with Chip Kelly, sometimes it didn't. But I think they're going to try to be very methodical and they're going to try to hold the ball a long time, really win that time of possession battle. But it really starts in training camp. You set the tone, you change the culture. You know, I'm being led to believe, and from what we're all being led to believe, it's going to be a much more physical training camp than it has been. And I'll be curious to see how that works out, and if it changes how the team. You know, we talked about Buddy Ryan, and you can say positive and negative things about Buddy Ryan, and we did that a few weeks ago. They were very physical camps, and there were a lot of scrums and things like that, but I think it made them a more physical football team when the season started. And I, you know, I'd be curious to see how it changes this team's personality as well, if Doug Peterson really follows through and has a more physical camp. So that's one thing to kind of look forward to with training camp starting.
Yeah, of course, they can't do what Buddy did because the NFL rules prohibit what Buddy had them do, but it could certainly be more physical than it was under Chip Kelly. Josh, your final thought?
Yeah, well, just one quick point about Gordon. If Doug Peterson, he is an Andy Reid protege, and Andy Reid usually had some pretty physical camps, so we could possibly see that under Doug Peterson as well. But my final thought, I'm going to go to a sport we don't talk about too much, a sport I love to play, and that's golf. The British Open was this past weekend, and you've got to feel a little bit bad for Lefty. Phil Mickelson, a lot of second-place finishes, and once again, he finishes second place. In any other year, he probably would have won the tournament. He was 17 under in the British Open. Henrik Stenson, though, wins it at 20 under, and he ties a record for final rounds in a championship match with the final round 63 to win it 8 under. So very impressive for Henrik Stenson. And Phil Mickelson, just a little profile of him. He's, you know, we talked about Tim Duncan's legacy. Phil Mickelson is currently 46 years old, so still to compete at that age and be right in the thick of things is very impressive. He almost has the golf grand slam, only missing the U.S. Open. He has 5 major championships, 3 Masters titles, a PGA championship, and a British Open championship. So he's a guy that finishes second a lot, and it doesn't quite win all the championships, but he has had a pretty impressive career. He was in golf. You don't have to wait till you retire. So he was already inducted to the Hall of Fame in golf, and You kind of feel bad for him because although he does have 5 championships and he has won 42 events on the PGA Tour, which is very impressive. He's during his career, you would say he's the second best golfer of his generation after Tiger Woods. But he's come up just a little bit short in a lot of matches. So that's my final thought for today.
Well, this will be a first because, Josh, I'm going to talk about the same subject you did, which we don't usually have 2 golf final thoughts. But Phil Mickelson was my topic as well. I'm not going to repeat what you said, but I think when you look at his 11 runner-ups in the majors, which is second only to Jack Nicklaus, which is interesting also because Jack Nicklaus won the Masters at age 46, which is the same age as Mickelson is now. And Mickelson almost pulls out this British Open. So at the same time, though, he didn't like Nicklaus, you can't say he lost these. I mean, some of those runner-ups were the Tiger Woods, which was playing exceptional. And, you know, even here, he's 17 under at the British Open, only because Henrik Stenson goes out and shoots a 63 today, which ties the record for the lowest round in major championship history. And his 20 under is the record for the British Open, period. Ironically, Mickelson shot 63 in the first round. It was really fun to watch him. So, like I said, he didn't lose the tournament. He shot 65 today. Stenson won the tournament and with his 63. And also, you know, it was really fun watching him play. And I was traveling today, so I didn't see as much of today's round as I wanted to. But even Thursday, when Mickelson had a chance, he almost set the record for the lowest round in a major. His putt lipped out on the 18th hole, and it looked good. Mickelson thought it was good, too, ready for the lowest score ever. And it looked out, but you know, it was really fun to watch. It was really fun to see him capture that magic again. Golf has become kind of staid. I mean, you know, some of these guys are great players, but with Tiger Woods not playing so well, and being hurt and all that stuff, you know, it was, who's the star? Who's the guy that's going to attract the viewers? That have, you know, sort of everything's just sort of become routine, and some of them come off as almost robotic. Phil Mickelson is a personality. And it was really fun to watch him, even though he didn't win, to watch him recapture that magic at the British Open. And I hope, you know, we see more of that or somebody else do something like that. So that's it for this week's show. Josh, Gordon, great job. Thank you, both of you. This was a terrific show today. Lots of good conversation on a lot of different topics. Next week, Gordon will not be with us, barring flight delays. And actually, I don't know if we want Gordon on the air. If Gordon, I don't know if you're going to be in a mood to be on the air if you have the flight delay. So, no offense, but I hope we don't talk to you next week. But really, great stuff this week. We will be back talking a lot of Eagles training camp next week, and that's it for this week's show. So, thank you very much. Thank you to Bill the caller as well for his really good question adding to our Sixers conversation. And we will talk to you next week. And thank you. Have a good week, everybody.